races. Selection favors memes that exploit their cultural environment to their own advantage. This cultural environment consists of other memes which are also being selected. The meme pool therefore comes to have the attributes of an evolutionarily stable set, which new memes find it hard to invade. I've been a bit negative about memes, but they have their cheerful side as well. When we die, there are two things we can leave behind us, genes and memes. We were built as gene machines, created to pass on our genes. But that aspect of us will be forgotten in three generations. Your child, even your grandchild, may bear a resemblance to you, perhaps in facial features, in a talent for music, in the color of her hair. But as each generation passes, the contribution of your genes is halved. It does not take long to reach negligible proportions. Our genes may be immortal, but the collection of genes, that is any one of us, is bound to crumble away. Elizabeth II is a direct descendant of William the Conqueror. Yet it is quite probable that she bears not a single one of the old king's genes. We should not seek immortality in reproduction. But if you contribute to the world's culture, if you have a good idea, compose a tune, invent a sparking plug, write a poem, it may live on, intact, long after your genes have dissolved in the common pool. Socrates may or may not have a gene or two alive in the world, as G.C. Williams has remarked, but who cares? The meme complexes of Socrates, Leonardo, Copernicus, and Marconi are still going strong. However speculative my development of the theory of memes may be, there is one serious point which I would like to emphasize once again. This is that when we look at the evolution of cultural traits and at their survival value, we must be clear whose survival we are talking about. Biologists, as we have seen, are accustomed to looking for advantages at the gene level, or the individual, the group, or the species level, according to taste. What we have not previously considered is that a cultural trait may have evolved in the way that it has simply because it is advantageous to itself. We do not have to look for conventional biological survival values of traits like religion, music, and ritual dancing, though these may also be present. Once the genes have provided their survival machines with brains that are capable of rapid imitation, the memes will automatically take over. We do not even have to posit a genetic advantage in imitation, though that would certainly help. All that is necessary is that the brain should be capable of imitation. Memes will then evolve that exploit the capability to the full.
Let us close the topic of the new replicators and end the chapter on a note of qualified hope. One unique feature of man, which may or may not have evolved mimically, is his capacity for conscious foresight. Selfish genes, and if you allow the speculation of this chapter, memes too, have no foresight. They are unconscious, blind replicators. The fact that they replicate, together with certain further conditions, means willy-nilly that they will tend towards the evolution of qualities which, in the special sense of this book, can be called selfish. A simple replicator, whether gene or meme, cannot be expected to forego short-term selfish advantage, even if it would really pay it in the long term, to do so. We saw this in the chapter on aggression. Even though a conspiracy of doves would be better for every single individual than the evolutionarily stable strategy, natural selection is bound to favour the ESS.
It is possible that yet another unique quality of man is a capacity for genuine, disinterested, true altruism. I hope so, but I'm not going to argue the case one way or the other, nor to speculate over its possible memic evolution. The point I'm making now is that even if we look on the dark side and assume that individual man is fundamentally selfish, our conscious foresight, our capacity to simulate the future in imagination, could save us from the worst selfish excesses of the blind replicators.
We have at least the mental equipment to foster our long-term selfish interests rather than merely our short-term selfish interests. We can see the long-term benefits of participating in a conspiracy of doves, and we can sit down together to discuss ways of making the conspiracy work. We have the power to defy the selfish genes of our birth, and if necessary, the selfish memes of our indoctrination. We can even discuss ways of deliberately cultivating and nurturing pure, disinterested altruism. Something that has no place in nature, something that has never existed before in the whole history of the world. We are built as gene machines and cultured as meme machines, but we have the power to turn against our creators. We, alone on Earth, can rebel against the tyranny of the selfish replicators.
End note. That was the end of the first edition. Its optimistic tone has provoked skepticism among critics who feel that it is inconsistent with the rest of the book. In some cases, the criticism comes from doctrinaire sociobiologists jealously protective of the importance of genetic influence. In other cases, the criticism comes from a paradoxically opposite quarter, high priests of the left, jealously protective of a favorite demonological icon. Rose, Kamin, and Lewontin in Not in Our Genes have a private bogey called reductionism, and all the best reductionists are also supposed to be determinists, preferably genetic determinists. They write, "Brains for reductionists are determinate biological objects whose properties produce the behaviors we observe and the states of thought or intention we infer from that behavior. Such a position is, or ought to be, completely in accord with the principles of sociobiology offered by Wilson and Dawkins. However, to adopt it would involve them in the dilemma of first arguing the innateness of much human behavior that, being liberal men, they clearly find unattractive, spite, indoctrination, etc., and then to become entangled in liberal ethical concerns about responsibility for criminal acts, if these, like all other acts, are biologically determined. To avoid this problem, Wilson and Dawkins invoke a free will that enables us to go against the dictates of our genes if we so wish. This is essentially a return to unabashed Cartesianism, a dualistic deus ex machina." I think that Rose and his colleagues are accusing us of eating our cake and having it. Either we must be genetic determinists, or we believe in free will. We cannot have it both ways. But, and here I presume to speak for Professor Wilson as well as for myself, it is only in the eyes of Rose and his colleagues that we are genetic determinists. What they don't understand, apparently, though it's hard to credit, is that it is perfectly possible to hold that genes exert a statistical influence on human behavior, while at the same time believing that this influence can be modified, overridden, or reversed by other influences. Genes must exert a statistical influence on any behavior pattern that evolves by natural selection. Presumably, Rose and his colleagues agree that human sexual desire has evolved by natural selection, in the same sense as anything ever evolved by natural selection. They therefore must agree that there have been genes influencing sexual desire, in the same sense as genes ever influence anything. Yet they presumably have no trouble with curbing their sexual desires when it is socially necessary to do so. What is dualist about that? Obviously nothing. And no more is it dualist for me to advocate rebelling against the tyranny of the selfish replicators. We, that is our brains, are separate and independent enough from our genes to rebel against them. As already noted, we do so in a small way every time we use contraception. There is no reason why we should not rebel in a large way, too. Note: we now come to the two additional chapters, first published in the second edition of 1989.
Chapter 12. Nice Guys Finish First. Nice guys finish last. The phrase seems to have originated in the world of baseball, although some authorities claim priority for an alternative connotation. The American biologist Garrett Hardin used it to summarize the message of what may be called sociobiology or selfish genery. It's easy to see its aptness. If we translate the colloquial meaning of nice guy into its Darwinian equivalent, a nice guy is an individual that assists other members of its species, at its own expense, to pass their genes on to the next generation. Nice guys then seem bound to decrease in numbers. Niceness dies a Darwinian death. But there is another technical interpretation of the colloquial word nice. If we adopt this definition, which is not too far from the colloquial meaning, nice guys can finish first. This more optimistic conclusion is what this chapter is about.
Remember the grudgers of chapter 10. These were birds that helped each other in an apparently altruistic way, but refused to help, bore a grudge against, individuals that had previously refused to help them. Grudgers came to dominate the population because they passed on more genes to future generations than either suckers, who helped others indiscriminately and were exploited, or cheats, who tried ruthlessly to exploit everybody and ended up doing each other down. The story of the grudgers illustrated an important general principle, which Robert Trivers called reciprocal altruism. As we saw in the example of the cleaner fish, reciprocal altruism is not confined to members of a single species. It is at work in all relationships that are called symbiotic, for instance the ants milking their aphid cattle. Since Chapter 10 was written, the American political scientist Robert Axelrod, working partly in collaboration with W.D. Hamilton, whose name has cropped up on so many pages of this book, has taken the idea of reciprocal altruism on in exciting new directions. It was Axelrod who coined the technical meaning of the word nice, to which I alluded in my opening paragraph. Axelrod, like many political scientists, economists, mathematicians, and psychologists, was fascinated by a simple gambling game called Prisoner's Dilemma. It is so simple that I've known clever men misunderstand it completely, thinking that there must be more to it. But its simplicity is deceptive. Whole shelves in libraries are devoted to the ramifications of this beguiling game. Many influential people think it holds the key to strategic defense planning, and that we should study it to prevent a Third World War. As a biologist, I agree with Axelrod and Hamilton that many wild animals and plants are engaged in ceaseless games of prisoner's dilemma, played out in evolutionary time.
In its original human version, here is how the game is played. There is a banker who adjudicates and pays out winnings to the two players. Suppose that I am playing against you, though as we shall see, against is precisely what we don't have to be. There are only two cards in each of our hands, labelled Cooperate and Defect. To play, we each choose one of our cards and lay it face down on the table. Face down so that neither of us can be influenced by the other's move. In effect, we move simultaneously. We now wait in suspense for the banker to turn the cards over. The suspense is because our winnings depend not just on which card we have played, which we each know, but on the other player's card too, which we don't know until the banker reveals it. Since there are 2 times 2 cards, there are 4 possible outcomes. For each outcome, our winnings are as follows, quoted in dollars in deference to the North American origins of the game. Outcome 1. We have both played Cooperate. The banker pays each of us $300. This respectable sum is called the reward for mutual cooperation. Outcome 2. We have both played Defect. The banker fines each of us $10. This is called the punishment for mutual defection. Outcome 3. You have played Cooperate. I have played Defect. The banker pays me $500, the temptation to defect, and fines you, the sucker, $100. Outcome 4. You have played Defect. I have played Cooperate. The banker pays you the temptation payoff of $500 and fines me, the sucker, $100.
Outcomes 3 and 4 are obviously mirror images. One player does very well and the other does very badly. In outcomes 1 and 2, we do as well as one another, but 1, where we both play Cooperate, is better for both of us than 2. The exact quantities of money don't matter. It doesn't even matter how many are positive payments and how many of them, if any, are negative fines. What matters for the game to qualify as a true prisoner's dilemma is their rank order. The temptation to defect must be better than the reward for mutual cooperation, which must be better than the punishment for mutual defection, which must be better than the sucker's payoff. Strictly speaking, there is one further condition for the game to qualify as a true prisoner's dilemma. The average of the temptation and the sucker payoffs must not exceed the reward. The reason for this additional condition will emerge later. Now, why the dilemma? Imagine the thoughts that might go through my head as I play against you. I know that there are only two cards you can play, cooperate and defect. Let's consider them in order. If you played defect, the best card I could have played would have been defect too. Admittedly, I'd have suffered the penalty for mutual defection, but if I'd cooperated, I'd have got the sucker's payoff, which is even worse. Now let's turn to the other thing you could have done. Play the cooperate card. Once again, defect is the best thing I could have done. If I had cooperated, we'd both have got the rather high score of $300. But if I'd defected, I'd have got even more, $500. The conclusion is that, regardless of which card you play, my best move is always defect. So I've worked out by impeccable logic that regardless of what you do, I must defect. And you, with no less impeccable logic, will work out just the same thing. So when two rational players meet, they will both defect, and both will end up with a fine or low payoff. Yet each knows perfectly well that if only they had both played cooperate, both would have obtained the relatively high reward for mutual cooperation, $300 in our example. That is why the game is called a dilemma, why it seems so maddeningly paradoxical, and why it has even been proposed that there ought to be a law against it.
Prisoner comes from one particular imaginary example. The currency in this case is not money, but prison sentences. Two men, call them Peterson and Moriarty, are in jail, suspected of collaborating in a crime. Each prisoner, in his separate cell, is invited to betray his colleague, defect, by turning King's evidence against him. What happens depends upon what both prisoners do, and neither knows what the other has done. If Peterson throws the blame entirely on Moriarty, and Moriarty renders the story plausible by remaining silent, cooperating with his erstwhile and, as it turns out, treacherous friend, Moriarty gets a heavy jail sentence, while Peterson gets off scot-free, having yielded to the temptation to defect. If each betrays the other, both are convicted of the crime, but receive some credit for giving evidence and get a somewhat reduced, though still stiff, sentence, the punishment for mutual defection. If both cooperate, with each other, not with the authorities, by refusing to speak, there is not enough evidence to convict either of them of the main crime, and they receive a small sentence for a lesser offence, the reward for mutual cooperation. Although it may seem odd to call a jail sentence a reward, that is how the men would see it if the alternative was a longer spell behind bars. You will notice that although the payoffs are not in dollars but in jail sentences, the essential features of the game are preserved. If you put yourself in each prisoner's place, assuming both to be motivated by rational self-interest, and remembering that they cannot talk to one another to make a pact, you will see that neither has any choice but to betray the other, thereby condemning both to heavy sentences.
Is there any way out of the dilemma? Both players know that whatever their opponent does, they themselves cannot do better than defect. Yet both also know that if only both had cooperated, each one would have done better. If only, if only, if only there could be some way of reaching agreement, some way of reassuring each player that the other can be trusted not to go for the selfish jackpot, some way of policing the agreement.
In the simple game of Prisoner's Dilemma, there is no way of ensuring trust. Unless at least one of the players is a really saintly sucker, too good for this world, the game is doomed to end in mutual defection, with its paradoxically poor result for both players. But there is another version of the game. It is called the iterated or repeated prisoner's dilemma. The iterated game is more complicated and in its complication lies hope.
The iterated game is simply the ordinary game repeated an indefinite number of times with the same players. Once again, you and I face each other with a banker sitting between. Once again, we each have a hand of just two cards labeled cooperate and defect. Once again, we move by each playing one or other of these cards, and the banker shells out or levies fines according to the rules given above. But now, instead of that being the end of the game, we pick up our cards and prepare for another round. The successive rounds of the game give us the opportunity to build up trust or mistrust, to reciprocate or placate, forgive or avenge. In an indefinitely long game, the important point is that we can both win at the expense of the banker rather than at the expense of one another. After 10 rounds of the game, I could theoretically have won as much as $5,000, but only if you have been extraordinarily silly or saintly and played cooperate every time, in spite of the fact that I was consistently defecting. More realistically, it is easy for each of us to pick up $3,000 of the banker's money by both playing cooperate on all 10 rounds of the game. For this, we don't have to be particularly saintly, because we can both see from the other's past moves that the other is to be trusted. We can, in effect, police each other's behaviour. Another thing that is quite likely to happen is that neither of us trust the other. We both play defect for all 10 rounds of the game, and the banker gains $100 in fines from each of us. Most likely of all is that we partially trust one another and each play some mixed sequence of cooperate and defect, ending up with some intermediate sum of money.
The birds in Chapter 10, who removed ticks from each other's feathers, were playing an iterated prisoner's dilemma game. How is this so? It is important, you remember, for a bird to pull off his own ticks, but he cannot reach the top of his own head and needs a companion to do that for him. It would seem only fair that he should return the favour later. But this service costs a bird time and energy, albeit not much. If a bird can get away with cheating, with having his own ticks removed but then refusing to reciprocate, he gains all the benefits without paying the costs. Rank the outcomes and you'll find that indeed we have a true game of prisoner's dilemma. Both cooperating, pulling each other's ticks off, is pretty good, but there is still a temptation to do even better by refusing to pay the costs of reciprocating. Both defecting, refusing to pull ticks off, is pretty bad, but not so bad as putting effort into pulling another's ticks off and still ending up infested with ticks oneself. But this is only one example. The more you think about it, the more you realise that life is riddled with iterated prisoner's dilemma games. Not just human life, but animal and plant life too. Plant life? Well, yes, why not? Remember that we are not talking about conscious strategies, though at times we might be, but about strategies in the Maynard Smithian sense, strategies of the kind that genes might pre-program. Later, we shall meet plants, various animals, and even bacteria, all playing the game of iterated prisoner's dilemma. Meanwhile, let's explore more fully what is so important about iteration.
Unlike the simple game, which is rather predictable in that defect is the only rational strategy, the iterated version offers plenty of strategic scope. In the simple game, there are only two possible strategies, cooperate and defect. Iteration, however, allows lots of conceivable strategies, and it is by no means obvious which one is best. The following, for instance, is just one among thousands. Cooperate most of the time, but on a random 10% of rounds, throw in a defect. Or strategies might be conditional upon the past history of the game. My Grudger is an example of this. It has a good memory for faces, and although fundamentally cooperative, it defects if the other player has ever defected before. Other strategies might be more forgiving and have shorter memories. Clearly, the strategies available in the iterated game are limited only by our ingenuity. Can we work out which is best? This was the task that Axelrod set himself. He had the entertaining idea of running a competition, and he advertised for experts in games theory to submit strategies. Strategies in this sense are pre-programmed rules for action, so it was appropriate for contestants to send in their entries in computer language. 14 strategies were submitted. For good measure, Axelrod added a 15th called random, which simply played cooperate and defect randomly, and served as a kind of baseline non-strategy. If a strategy can't do better than random, it must be pretty bad. Axelrod translated all 15 strategies into one common programming language and set them against one another in one big computer. Each strategy was paired off in turn with every other one, including a copy of itself, to play Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma. Since there were 15 strategies, there were 15 times 15, or 225, separate games going on in the computer. When each pairing had gone through 200 moves of the game, the winnings were totaled up and the winner declared. We are not concerned with which strategy won against any particular opponent. What matters is which strategy accumulated the most money, summed over all its 15 pairings. Money simply means points awarded according to the following scheme: mutual cooperation 3 points, temptation to defect 5 points, punishment for mutual defection 1 point, equivalent to a light fine in our earlier game, sucker's payoff 0 points, equivalent to a heavy fine in our earlier game.
The maximum possible score that any strategy could achieve was 15,000, 200 rounds at 5 points per round for each of 15 opponents. The minimum possible score was 0. Needless to say, neither of these two extremes was realized. The most that a strategy can realistically hope to win in an average one of its 15 pairings cannot be much more than 600 points. This is what two players would each receive if they both consistently cooperated, scoring 3 points for each of the 200 rounds of the game. If one of them succumbed to the temptation to defect, it would very probably end up with fewer points than 600 because of retaliation by the other player. Most of the submitted strategies had some kind of retaliatory behaviour built into them. We can use 600 as a kind of benchmark for a game and express all scores as a percentage of this benchmark. On this scale, it is theoretically possible to score up to 166%, 1,000 points, but in practice no strategy's average score exceeded 600. Remember that the players in the tournament were not humans, but computer programs, pre-programmed strategies. Their human authors played the same role as genes programming bodies. Think of Chapter 4's Computer Chess and the Andromeda Computer. You can think of the strategies as miniature proxies for their authors. Indeed, one author could have submitted more than one strategy, although it would have been cheating, and Axelrod would presumably not have allowed it, for an author to pack the competition with strategies, one of which received the benefits of sacrificial cooperation from the others. Some ingenious strategies were submitted, though they were, of course, far less ingenious than their authors. The winning strategy, remarkably, was the simplest and superficially least ingenious of all. It was called Tit for Tat, and was submitted by Professor Anatole Rappaport, a well-known psychologist and games theorist from Toronto. Tit for Tat begins by cooperating on the first move, and thereafter simply copies the previous move of the other player.
How might a game involving Tit for Tat proceed? As ever, what happens depends upon the other player. Suppose first that the other player is also tit for tat. Remember that each strategy played against copies of itself, as well against the other 14. Both tit for tats begin by cooperating. In the next move, each player copies the other's previous move, which was cooperate. Both continue to cooperate until the end of the game, and both end up with the full 100% benchmark score of 600 points. Now suppose Tit for Tat plays against a strategy called Naive Prober. Naive Prober wasn't actually entered in Axelrod's competition, but it is instructive nevertheless. It is basically identical to Tit for Tat, except that, once in a while, say on a random 1 in 10 moves, it throws in a gratuitous defection and claims the high temptation score. Until Naive Prober tries one of its probing defections, the players might as well be two Tit for Tats. A long and mutually profitable sequence of cooperation seemed set to run its course with a comfortable 100% benchmark score for both players. But suddenly, without warning, say on the eighth move, Naive Prober defects. Tit for Tat, of course, has played cooperate on this move, and so is landed with the sucker's payoff of 0 points. Naive Prober appears to have done well, since it has obtained 5 points from that move. But in the next move, Tit for Tat retaliates. It plays defect, simply following its rule of imitating the opponent's previous move. Naive Prober, meanwhile, blindly following its built-in copying rule, has copied its opponent's cooperate move. So it now collects the sucker's payoff of 0 points, while Tit for Tat gets the high score of 5. In the next move, Naive Prober, rather unjustly one might think, retaliates against Tit for Tat's defection. And so the alternation continues. During these alternating runs, both players receive, on average, 2.5 points per move, the average of 5 and 0. This is lower than the steady 3 points per move that both players can amass in a run of mutual cooperation. And by the way, this is the reason for the additional condition left unexplained earlier. So, when Naive Prober plays against Tit for Tat, both do worse than when Tit for Tat plays against another Tit for Tat. And when Naive Prober plays against another Naive Prober, both tend to do, if anything, even worse still, since runs of reverberating defection tend to get started earlier.
Now consider another strategy called Remorseful Prober. Remorseful Prober is like Naive Prober, except that it takes active steps to break out of runs of alternating recrimination. To do this, it needs a slightly longer memory than either Tit for Tat or Naive Prober. Remorseful Prober remembers whether it has just spontaneously defected and whether the result was prompt retaliation. If so, it remorsefully allows its opponent one free hit without retaliating. This means that runs of mutual recrimination are nipped in the bud. If you now work through an imaginary game between Remorseful Prober and Tit for Tat, you'll find that runs of would-be mutual retaliation are promptly scotched. Most of the game is spent in mutual cooperation, with both players enjoying the consequent generous score. Remorseful Prober does better against Tit for Tat than Naive Prober does, though not as well as Tit for Tat does against itself.
Some of the strategies entered in Axelrod's tournament were much more sophisticated than either Remorseful Prober or Naive Prober, but they too ended up with fewer points on average than simple Tit for Tat. Indeed, the least successful of all the strategies, except random, was the most elaborate. It was submitted by Name Withheld, a spur to pleasing speculation. Some eminence grise in the Pentagon, the head of the CIA, Henry Kissinger, Axelrod himself. I suppose we shall never know.
It isn't all that interesting to examine the details of the particular strategies that were submitted. This isn't a book about the ingenuity of computer programmers. It is more interesting to classify strategies according to certain categories and examine the success of these broader divisions. The most important category that Axelrod recognizes is nice. A nice strategy is defined as one that is never the first to defect. Tit for Tat is an example. It is capable of defecting, but it does so only in retaliation. Both Naive Prober and Remorseful Prober are nasty strategies because they sometimes defect, however rarely, when not provoked. Of the 15 strategies entered in the tournament, 8 were nice. Significantly, the 8 top-scoring strategies were the very same 8 nice strategies, the 7 nasties trailing well behind. Tit for Tat obtained an average of 504.5 points, 84% of our benchmark of 600, and a good score. The other nice strategies scored only slightly less, with scores ranging from 83.4% down to 78.6%. There is a big gap between this score and the 66.8% obtained by Graskamp, the most successful of all the nasty strategies. It seems pretty convincing that nice guys do well in this game. Another of Axelrod's technical terms is forgiving. A forgiving strategy is one that, although it may retaliate, has a short memory. It is swift to overlook old misdeeds. Tit for tat is a forgiving strategy. It wraps a defector over the knuckles instantly, but after that, lets bygones be bygones. Chapter 10's grudger is totally unforgiving. Its memory lasts the entire game. It never forgets a grudge against a player who has ever defected against it, even once. A strategy, formerly identical to grudger, was entered in Axelrod's tournament under the name of Freedman, and it didn't do particularly well. Of all the nice strategies, note that it is technically nice, although it is totally unforgiving, Grudger Freedman did next to worst. The reason unforgiving strategies don't do very well is that they can't break out of runs of mutual recrimination even when their opponent is remorseful. It is possible to be even more forgiving than tit for tat. Tit for two tats allows its opponents two defections in a row before it eventually retaliates. This might seem excessively saintly and magnanimous. Nevertheless, Axelrod worked out that if only somebody had submitted tit for two tats, it would have won the tournament. This is because it is so good at avoiding runs of mutual recrimination.
So we have identified two characteristics of winning strategies, niceness and forgivingness. This almost utopian-sounding conclusion that niceness and forgivingness pay came as a surprise to many of the experts who had tried to be too cunning by submitting subtly nasty strategies, while even those who had submitted nice strategies had not dared anything so forgiving as tit-for-two-tats. Axelrod announced a second tournament. He received 62 entries and again added random, making 63 in all. This time the exact number of moves per game was not fixed at 200, but was left open for a good reason that I shall come to later. We can still express scores as a percentage of the benchmark or always cooperate score, even though that benchmark needs more complicated calculation and is no longer a fixed 600 points. Programmers in the second tournament had all been provided with the results of the first, including Axelrod's analysis of why tit-for-tat and other nice and forgiving strategies had done so well. It was only to be expected that the contestants would take note of this background information in one way or another. In fact, they split into two schools of thought. Some reasoned that niceness and forgivingness were evidently winning qualities, and they accordingly submitted nice, forgiving strategies. John Maynard Smith went so far as to submit the super-forgiving tit-for-two-tats. The other school of thought reasoned that lots of their colleagues, having read Axelrod's analysis, would now submit nice, forgiving strategies. They therefore submitted nasty strategies trying to exploit these anticipated softies.
But once again, nastiness didn't pay. Once again, tit-for-tat, submitted by Anatole Rappaport, was the winner, and it scored a massive 96% of the benchmark score. And once again, nice strategies, in general, did better than nasty ones. All but one of the top 15 strategies were nice, and all but one of the bottom 15 were nasty. But although the saintly tit-for-two-tats would have won the first tournament if it had been submitted, it did not win the second. This was because the field now included more subtle, nasty strategies capable of preying ruthlessly upon such an out-and-out softy. This underlines an important point about these tournaments. Success for a strategy depends upon which other strategies happen to be submitted. This is the only way to account for the difference between the second tournament, in which Tit for Two Tats was ranked well down the list, and the first tournament, which Tit for Two Tats would have won. But as we said before, this is not a book about the ingenuity of computer programmers. Is there an objective way in which we can judge which is the truly best strategy in a more general and less arbitrary sense? If you have heard the earlier chapters, you will already be prepared to find the answer in the theory of evolutionarily stable strategies.
I was one of those to whom Axelrod circulated his early results with an invitation to submit a strategy for the second tournament. I didn't do so, but I did make another suggestion. Axelrod had already begun to think in ESS terms, but I felt that this tendency was so important that I wrote to him suggesting that he should get in touch with W.D. Hamilton, who was then, though Axelrod didn't know it, in a different department of the same university, the University of Michigan. He did indeed immediately contact Hamilton, and the result of their subsequent collaboration was a brilliant joint paper published in the journal Science in 1981, a paper that won the Newcomb Cleveland Prize of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In addition to discussing some delightfully way-out biological examples of iterated prisoners' dilemmas, Axelrod and Hamilton gave what I regard as due recognition to the ESS approach.
Contrast the ESS approach with the round-robin system that Axelrod's two tournaments followed. A round-robin is like a football league. Each strategy was matched against each other strategy an equal number of times. The final score of a strategy was the sum of the points it gained against all the other strategies. To be successful in a round-robin tournament, therefore, a strategy has to be a good competitor against all the other strategies that people happen to have submitted. Axelrod's name for a strategy that is good against a wide variety of other strategies is robust. Tit for tat turned out to be a robust strategy. But the set of strategies that people happen to have submitted is an arbitrary set. This was the point that worried us above. It just so happened that in Axelrod's original tournament, about half the entries were nice. Tit for tat won in this climate, and tit for two tats would have won in this climate if it had been submitted. But suppose that nearly all the entries had just happened to be nasty. This could very easily have occurred. After all, 6 out of the 14 strategies submitted were nasty. If 13 of them had been nasty, tit for tat wouldn't have won. The climate would have been wrong for it. Not only the money won, but the rank order of success among strategies depends upon which strategies happen to have been submitted. Depends, in other words, upon something as arbitrary as human whim. How can we reduce this arbitrariness? By thinking ESS.
The important characteristic of an evolutionarily stable strategy, you'll remember from earlier chapters, is that it carries on doing well when it is already numerous in the population of strategies. To say that tit-for-tat, say, is an ESS would be to say that tit-for-tat does well in a climate dominated by tit-for-tat. This could be seen as a special kind of robustness. As evolutionists, we are tempted to see it as the only kind of robustness that matters. Why does it matter so much? Because in the world of Darwinism, winnings are not paid out as money, they are paid out as offspring. To a Darwinian, a successful strategy is one that has become numerous in the population of strategies. For a strategy to remain successful, it must do well specifically when it is numerous, that is, in a climate dominated by copies of itself. Axelrod did, as a matter of fact, run a third round of his tournament, as natural selection might have run it, looking for an ESS. Actually, he didn't call it a third round, since he didn't solicit new entries, but used the same 63 as for round 2. I find it convenient to treat it as round 3, because I think it differs from the two round-robin tournaments more fundamentally than the two round-robin tournaments differ from each other. Axelrod took the 63 strategies and threw them again into the computer to make generation 1 of an evolutionary succession. In generation 1, therefore, the climate consisted of an equal representation of all 63 strategies. At the end of generation 1, winnings to each strategy were paid out, not as money or points, but as offspring, identical to their asexual parents. As generations went by, some strategies became scarcer and eventually went extinct. Other strategies became more numerous. As the proportions changed, so consequently did the climate in which future moves of the game took place. Eventually, after about 1,000 generations, there were no further changes in proportions, no further changes in climate. Stability was reached. Before this, the fortunes of the various strategies rose and fell, just as in my computer simulation of the cheats, suckers, and grudgers. Some of the strategies started going extinct from the start, and most were extinct by generation 200. Of the nasty strategies, one or two of them began by increasing in frequency, but their prosperity, like that of cheat in my simulation, was short-lived. The only nasty strategy to survive beyond Generation 200 was one called Harrington. Harrington's fortunes rose steeply for about the first 150 generations. Thereafter, it declined rather gradually, approaching extinction around Generation 1000. Harrington did well temporarily for the same reason as my original cheat did. It exploited softies like tit-for-two-tats, too forgiving, while these were still around. Then, as the softies were driven extinct, Harrington followed them, having no easy prey left. The field was free for nice, but provocable strategies, like tit-for-tat. Tit-for-tat itself indeed came out top in 5 out of 6 runs of round 3, just as it had in rounds 1 and 2. 5 other nice but provocable strategies ended up nearly as successful, frequent in the population, as tit-for-tat. Indeed, one of them won the 6th run. When all the nasties had been driven extinct, there was no way in which any of the nice strategies could be distinguished from tit-for-tat or from each other, because they all, being nice, simply played cooperate against each other.
A consequence of this indistinguishability is that although tit-for-tat seems like an ESS, it is strictly not a true ESS. To be an ESS, remember, a strategy must not be invadable when it is common by a rare mutant strategy. Now, it is true that tit-for-tat cannot be invaded by any nasty strategy, but another nice strategy is a different matter. As we have just seen, in a population of nice strategies, they will all look and behave exactly like one another. They will all cooperate all the time. So any other nice strategy, like the totally saintly always cooperate, although admittedly it will not enjoy a positive selective advantage over tit-for-tat, can nevertheless drift into the population without being noticed. So technically, tit-for-tat is not an ESS. You might think that since the world stays just as nice, we could as well regard tit-for-tat as an ESS. But alas, look what happens next. Unlike tit-for-tat, always cooperate is not stable against invasion by nasty strategies such as always defect. Always defect does well against always cooperate since it gets the high temptation score every time. Nasty strategies like always defect will come in to keep down the numbers of two nice strategies like always cooperate. But although tit-for-tat is strictly speaking not a true ESS, it is probably fair to treat some sort of mixture of basically nice but retaliatory tit-for-tat-like strategies as roughly equivalent to an ESS in practice. Such a mixture might include a small admixture of nastiness. Robert Boyd and Jeffrey Lorberbaum, in one of the more interesting follow-ups to Axelrod's work, looked at a mixture of tit-for-two-tats and a strategy called suspicious tit-for-tat. Suspicious tit-for-tat is technically nasty, but it's not very nasty. It behaves just like tit-for-tat itself after the first move, but this is what makes it technically nasty. It does defect on the very first move of the game. In a climate entirely dominated by tit-for-tat, suspicious tit-for-tat does not prosper because its initial defection triggers an unbroken run of mutual recrimination. When it meets a tit-for-two-tats player, on the other hand, tit-for-two-tats' greater forgivingness nips this recrimination in the bud. Both players end the game with at least the benchmark, all-cooperate, score, and with suspicious tit-for-tat scoring a bonus for its initial defection. Boyd and Lorberbaum showed that a population of tit-for-tat could be invaded, evolutionarily speaking, by a mixture of tit-for-two-tats and suspicious tit-for-tat, the two prospering in each other's company. This combination is almost certainly not the only combination that could invade in this kind of way. There are probably lots of mixtures of slightly nasty strategies with nice and very forgiving strategies that are together capable of invading. Some might see this as a mirror for familiar aspects of human life.
Axelrod recognised that tit-for-tat is not strictly an ESS, and he therefore coined the phrase collectively stable strategy to describe it. As in the case of true ESSs, it is possible for more than one strategy to be collectively stable at the same time. And again, it is a matter of luck which one comes to dominate a population. Always defect is also stable, as well as tit for tat. In a population that has already come to be dominated by always defect, no other strategy does better. We can treat the system as bistable, with always defect being one of the stable points, tit for tat, or some mixture of mostly nice retaliatory strategies, the other stable point. Whichever stable point comes to dominate the population first will tend to stay dominant. But what does dominate mean in quantitative terms? How many tit-for-tats must there be in order for tit-for-tat to do better than always defect? That depends upon the detailed payoffs that the banker has agreed to shell out in this particular game. All we can say in general is that there is a critical frequency, a knife edge. On one side of the knife edge, the critical frequency of tit-for-tat is exceeded, and selection will favour more and more tit-for-tats. On the other side of the knife edge, the critical frequency of always defect is exceeded, and selection will favour more and more always defects. We met the equivalent of this knife edge, you'll remember, in the story of the grudgers and cheats in Chapter 10. It obviously matters, therefore, on which side of the knife edge a population happens to start. And we need to know how it might happen that a population could occasionally cross from one side of the knife edge to the other. Suppose we start with a population already sitting on the always defect side. The few tit-for-tat individuals don't meet each other often enough to be of mutual benefit. So natural selection pushes the population even further towards the always defect extreme. If only the population could just manage by random drift to get itself over the knife edge, it could coast down the slope to the tit-for-tat side, and everyone would do much better at the banker's, or nature's, expense. But of course, populations have no group will, no group intention or purpose. They cannot strive to leap the knife edge. They will cross it only if the undirected forces of nature happen to lead them across. How could this happen? One way to express the answer is that it might happen by chance. But chance is just a word expressing ignorance. It means determined by some as yet unknown or unspecified means. We can do a little better than chance. We can try to think of practical ways in which a minority of tit-for-tat individuals might happen to increase to the critical mass. This amounts to a quest for possible ways in which tit-for-tat individuals might happen to cluster together in sufficient numbers that they can all benefit at the banker's expense. This line of thought seems to be promising, but it is rather vague. How exactly might mutually resembling individuals find themselves clustered together in local aggregations? In nature, the obvious way is through genetic relatedness, kinship. Animals of most species are likely to find themselves living close to their sisters, brothers, and cousins, rather than to random members of the population. This is not necessarily through choice. It follows automatically from viscosity in the population. Viscosity means any tendency for individuals to continue living close to the place where they were born. For instance, through most of history and in most parts of the world, though not as it happens in our modern world, individual humans have seldom strayed more than a few miles from their birthplace. As a result, local clusters of genetic relatives tend to build up. I remember visiting a remote island off the west coast of Ireland and being struck by the fact that almost everyone on the island had the most enormous jug-handle ears. This could hardly have been because large ears suited the climate. There are strong offshore winds. It was because most of the inhabitants of the island were close kin of one another.
Genetic relatives will tend to be alike not just in facial features, but in all sorts of other respects as well. For instance, they will tend to resemble each other with respect to genetic tendencies to play, or not to play, tit-for-tat. So even if tit-for-tat is rare in the population as a whole, it may still be locally common. In a local area, tit-for-tat individuals may meet each other often enough to prosper from mutual cooperation, even though calculations that take into account only the global frequency in the total population might suggest that they are below the knife-edge critical frequency. If this happens, tit-for-tat individuals cooperating with one another in cozy little local enclaves, may prosper so well that they grow from small local clusters into larger local clusters. These local clusters may grow so large that they spread out into other areas, areas that had hitherto been dominated numerically by individuals playing always defect. In thinking of these local enclaves, our Irish island is a misleading parallel because it is physically cut off. Think instead of a large population in which there is not much movement, so that individuals tend to resemble their immediate neighbours more than their more distant neighbours, even though there is continuous interbreeding all over the whole area. Coming back to our knife edge then, tit for tat could surmount it. All that is required is a little local clustering of a sort that will naturally tend to arise in natural populations. Tit for tat has a built-in gift, even when rare, for crossing the knife edge over to its own side. It is as though there were a secret passage underneath the knife edge. But that secret passage contains a one-way valve. There is an asymmetry. Unlike tit for tat, always defect, though a true ESS, cannot use local clustering to cross the knife edge. On the contrary, local clusters of always defect individuals, far from prospering by each other's presence, do especially badly in each other's presence. Far from quietly helping one another at the expense of the banker, they do one another down. Always defect, then, unlike tit for tat, gets no help from kinship or viscosity in the population. So although tit for tat may be only dubiously an ESS, it has a sort of higher order stability. What can this mean? Surely stable is stable. Well, here we are taking a longer view. Always defect resists invasion for a long time. But if we wait long enough, perhaps thousands of years, tit for tat will eventually muster the numbers required to tip it over the knife edge, and the population will flip. But the reverse will not happen. Always defect, as we have seen, cannot benefit from clustering, and so does not enjoy this higher order stability.
Tit for tat, as we've seen, is nice, meaning never the first to defect, and forgiving, meaning that it has a short memory for past misdeeds. I now introduce another of Axelrod's evocative technical terms. Tit for tat is also not envious. To be envious, in Axelrod's terminology, means to strive for more money than the other player rather than for an absolutely large quantity of the banker's money. To be non-envious means to be quite happy if the other player wins just as much money as you do, so long as you both thereby win more from the banker. Tit for tat never actually wins a game. Think about it and you'll see that it cannot score more than its opponent in any particular game, because it never defects except in retaliation. The most it can do is draw with its opponent. But it tends to achieve each draw with a high shared score. Where tit-for-tat and other nice strategies are concerned, the very word opponent is inappropriate. Sadly, however, when psychologists set up games of iterated prisoner's dilemma between real humans, nearly all players succumb to envy and therefore do relatively poorly in terms of money. It seems that many people, perhaps without even thinking about it, would rather do down the other player than cooperate with the other player to do down the banker. Axelrod's work has shown what a mistake this is. It is only a mistake in certain kinds of game. Games theorists divide games into zero-sum and non-zero-sum. A zero-sum game is one in which a win for one player is a loss for the other. Chess is zero-sum, because the aim of each player is to win, and this means to make the other player lose. Prisoner's Dilemma, however, is a non-zero-sum game. There is a banker paying out money, and it is possible for the two players to link arms and laugh all the way to the bank. This talk of laughing all the way to the bank reminds me of a delightful line from Shakespeare.
The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Henry VI, Part 2.
In what are called civil disputes, there is often, in fact, great scope for cooperation. What looks like a zero-sum confrontation can, with a little goodwill, be transformed into a mutually beneficial non-zero-sum game. Consider divorce. A good marriage is obviously a non-zero-sum game, brimming with mutual cooperation. But even when it breaks down, there are all sorts of reasons why a couple could benefit by continuing to cooperate and treating their divorce too as non-zero sum. As if child welfare were not a sufficient reason, the fees of two lawyers will make a nasty dent in the family's finances. So obviously, a sensible and civilized couple begin by going together to see one lawyer, don't they? Well, actually, no. At least in England, and until recently in all 50 states of the USA, the law,